Do you have a favorite Beatle?
Chops and changes, of course it does. But working with Paul and going to his studio and being so blown away with his openness, I'm sure it has happened to him that people just sort of cease to function as a normal human in his presence. The fact that the man is still going and he's not sitting on a stool somewhere doing an acoustic gig because he's slowing down. He's playing to like 250,000 people in South America for those reasons and a whole load more pull at the moment.
Hey guys, I'm Billy, and welcome back to Half the Picture. I'm very excited to say that our guest this episode is Ollie Murray, the music documentarian behind such renowned projects as Now and Then, the last Beatles song, the short film, which came out a couple of years ago. And he's now got a project coming out again with the Beatles Anthology Episode 9, the last episode of the new Beatles Anthology series. I was especially excited to get Ollie on the pod because he's worked with some of my favourite artists of all time, like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and also has made profiles of Quincy Jones and Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club, you know, all these great scenes of music over the years. And I was really excited to get him on the pod just to dive deep into that sort of vein of music that he's documented and talk about the craft that he has in terms of building up these portraits of these great artists. And I'm really, really pleased with the chat we had. So without further ado, let's roll on my chat with Ollie Murray. Enjoy. Hey, Ollie, welcome to Half the Picture. How are you doing?
Very well. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. So I guess to kick off with, to give people a sense of the work that you've done, because you've done so many documentaries over the course of the last 6 years on different musical figures, people like Bill Wyman. You know, you've worked with the Beatles on Now and Then, the last Beatles single, which came out a couple of years ago. You did the short documentary for that. You did the Keith Richards episode of My Life as a Rolling Stone, which is fantastic. And now you're directing a brand new episode of the Beatles Anthology coming out next month. So I think it's fair to say it's been a busy few years for you, is it fair to say?
Yeah, when someone else points it out like that, it does. It's been a remarkable time for film and TV in general, the last 10 years or so. It really has. I think people look back at it as a golden age of productivity. But I mean, there was some not so great stuff too. But it's been a remarkable time to be a filmmaker, that's for sure. And to me, the most important thing as well is it's one thing to make film and television. It's another thing to make it and then be in a position where you can find your audience. And that's also been the big shift. I think, you know, being able to make small movies. So my first film, The Quiet One, was about Bill Wyman, but specifically about his unseen archive and his collection of not just Stones memorabilia, but all sorts of things. And then to make a documentary about Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club and have that go around the world and get recognized would have been almost impossible until the sort of streamer boom and all that kind of stuff. So the landscape's changed for the better and it's turning all the time. And maybe we've seen the peak, perhaps, sadly, but it's been great. It's been fantastic. Cannot complain.
I mean, going back to the beginning then for you, because of course, all these bands we've just mentioned, like, you know, the Stones and the Beatles and Ronnie Scott's, of course, like as you say, they're sort of quintessentially urban, I guess. Obviously, the Beatles coming from Liverpool and the Stones coming from London and, you know, and Ronnie Scott's, you know, being such a key part of Soho for the last 50, 60 years or so. But I guess for you, because you, I want to say you come from, because from Oxford, am I fair to say, sort of rural Oxford?
Rural Oxford. Yeah. Not a lot of filmmaking in rural Oxford. So I've been in London most of, certainly all of my professional life. Well, Oxford to London via Glasgow School of Art and then also New York, where I got to sort of get my hands on film equipment. That was really my film school, was a year in New York. And then I brought that back to London and started working on music videos primarily. And I had friends that were in bands. I was in bands growing up and started doing videos for free, then videos maybe a couple of £100, and then slowly but surely, you know, find yourself being able to pay your rent with it, which is sort of still, I think, by anyone's metric, a success. If you can pay your bills making movies, it's pretty great.
Yeah, it's the dream, isn't it? I guess when you say you were in bands, I mean, what instrument did you play in a band out of interest?
I played guitar and then latterly sort of got into bass. I actually got into bass because, sorry to all the very, very competent, great bass players out there, it's easier in a rock format, but that's kind of why I got into the video side of it. I was just as interested in the visual side, like the visual communication around a band and all these kinds of things. So the music, I didn't really like playing live. I'd much preferred being in a studio making music and also making videos and the planning and the kind of design elements of it. And that was the sort of seed that grew into being a full-time filmmaker.
Yeah, that's interesting, because linking that to, linking that to the Beatles, which of course is one of the main things we're to talk to you about today. As I say, you've directed the new episode of the Beatles Anthology documentary due out next month. And you also, but your relationship with the Beatles professionally started with the Now and Then short film, which you produced, you directed about the last Beatles single. Mm-hmm. What was your experience like working on the Now and Then short film? What was that like?
That was an amazing experience, because I didn't really think that, I don't think like most people, I don't think people thought there was much more music, if any, for the Beatles to release. Like everyone else, I think we thought, well, that's it. Mm. And then because of their work with Peter Jackson, they kind of realized that they could separate audio out and clean up this tape they had of a John Lennon demo. And they wanted to make something that would speak to a new audience, a new generation of fans. So that's really where I came in to the picture, as a fresh voice and a fresh point of view. And someone, I don't know everything there is to know about the Beatles. That's sort of, I kind of wear that on my sleeve, because you can read and look up everything there is about Beatles recording techniques or lyrics or the history or where they were and what Paul ate for breakfast on a Tuesday and how that related to whatever. So I kind of came at it with a fresh perspective and hopefully a fresh point of view, that you want to do right by the fans, of which that they are very passionate all over the world, and it means a huge amount. So that's something to be respected. And then on the other hand, I also think about a 17-year-old kid who's got a guitar for Christmas or whatever in the middle of nowhere, Arkansas, who thinks, oh, I need to check out the Beatles for the first time. And you have to kind of, you have those two extremes. And if you just sort of gun for the middle, you reach no one. So you sort of have to try and, a bit like running two parties or two events or something at the same time, you have to keep one plate in the air, go off and find some really specific Easter eggs or advance the understanding of the Beatles at a sort of really micro level, but then also look after the macro for people that don't know the order of the records. Or believe it or not, there were some people loosely affiliated with the production who wanted to know why, when we used interview footage from the 90s, there's only three of them. So it's not in the curriculum that we need to learn about. It sort of feels like it is, that we should know everything about the Beatles. Not everyone knows that John Lennon was murdered in 1980. Hmm. And that's just that soon, most people won't. So you kind of have to lock into that and just be comfortable with the fact that if one of the guy, Paul or Ringo, doesn't like what you've made, it will just never see the light of day. So that's kind of, they let you make pretty much anything you want, but what's hanging over the project's head is, but if at the end of the day it doesn't fit with what they want to do or for whatever reason, sort of gone.
Yeah.
So
I was going to ask about that, because as you say, the Beatles and also the other acts you've worked with, like the Stones, their image, these guys are, the biggest pop acts, some of all time in many ways, like it's the Beatles and the Stones, two kind of pillars. Their image is so sort of carefully curated, I think, at this point, because, they've been going for so long, especially the Stones, who are obviously still playing live and still doing what they're doing, even, and it's just Mick and Keith and Ronnie. So when you're in the edit, because we were talking before we rolled about how, like, a lot of documentary filmmaking is sort of assembled in the edit, and so when you're cutting the work together, do you find, have you got Paul and Ringo, whether in person or virtually, kind of looking over your shoulder going, can't have that in, or you can't have that in?
Not at all. My experience actually is that the more experience and often bigger the figure that you're making a film about, the more space they give you. A, they're super busy for a start, and B, they don't want to be on top of you. They're creatives of the highest caliber themselves. They know what happens if a bunch of people come in and sit on their shoulder when they're trying to write a record, for example. Mm. The process of sort of getting the gig takes a long time, and the conversations around what you want to do and the writing of the treatments and stuff with the fantastic people that they have in place to facilitate the different aspects of their brand. The Beatles and the Stones, they're brands now as well. They're big, big brands that are super busy and very, very valuable. So there's lots of gatekeepers and those kinds of people steering the ship in the right direction. So it's not something that you have a half hour meeting and suddenly you're off in this new direction. It's more like steering an oil tanker across the Atlantic. That, like, they know where they're going. There is a master plan that will, you know, if you take the Beatles, they've been so prolific over the last few years, like Get Back and all these other things. It's almost sort of one a year, of which, to my knowledge, the anthology is the last one of a run of things for a little bit. But these things are all kind of masterminded. Jonathan Clyde, who's the producer of all of their things,
works at Apple, doesn't he?
He does an amazing job of navigating that sort of ecosystem and making sure that everything sticks to that North Star, both individual projects and then the thing as a whole, you know, going somewhere that fits with something that means a hell of a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, including the Beatles themselves.
Which is pretty remarkable given that, you know, they're Paul and Ringo are now in their 80s and obviously George Martin's no longer with us, and it's Giles, his son, who's sort of also following that North Star of like, okay, if we put out a Beatles record, if we do Now and Then, you know, with Strings, you know, what would that be like? How would that sound? How can we make it sound sort of in keeping with the DNA of the band, the original band, as possible? So as we say, we're here to talk about the Beatles Anthology, which is your sort of the upcoming project you've got coming out, because for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, the Beatles Anthology is, because as we say, you know, there might be someone, you know, a kid in Arkansas who, you know, doesn't know the full story.
Plenty of people. I mean, it's quite confusing.
Yeah, there's a lot.
It's been out, sort of, but not quite like this.
Yeah.
It was a VHS box set when it first came out, if you can imagine such a thing.
Yeah, well, I remember buying it on DVD. That was how I sort of consumed it. And then I think it's only just now going, now they're just remastering the original documentary series about, I think, 5 or 6 episodes from the 90s now for Disney Plus. And it is an amazing documentary series. But you've done the last, I guess, postscript, final episode.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about what that's been like and what we can look forward to for that?
Yeah. Well, it's called Episode 9. Comes after number 8, believe it or not. And
no reference to Revolution number 9.
For anyone listening, do not read into it any further than that.
They will.
Oh yeah, of course they will. 1 to 8 has been remastered, which is a short statement to make, and a 2-year plus journey of finding the masters again and licensing it and working out, you know, if the master is not in the best of shape, what to do with it. And that's all gone down to New Zealand, where they use all sorts of artistry to pull its socks up to a place where we would expect it to be on somewhere like Disney Plus. You know, it's a huge, huge change from the mid-90s, you know, the sort of analog tape, and it was all 4:3, and they were TV hours, which meant, you know, roughly 45 minutes for ad breaks and all those things. And it was ITV that funded it back in the 90s, and that's all done, that's all set, it looks fantastic. And my job really was to kind of look at other bits and pieces that didn't fit the chronological narrative, because what 1 to 8 is from birth to 1970, end of the Beatles, that is preserved as it should be, as a, you know, the anthology. It's been lovingly sort of had its socks pulled up to a lovely Disney Plus presentation. And then my job was to look at all the other bits and pieces. And my favorite thing about it is it's untethered from the chronology, and it's really about how they felt. There's no contributors telling you what else was going on in the background, or we never pop out to an academic giving you context, or a musicologist talking about why it's so interesting they're doing a certain thing. It's just the band and their closest to close entourage, whether it's George Martin or, you know,
some of the road managers and those guys, the team.
Exactly. So I got to look at it. in a bit more of a modern sense, really, of looking at the weight of that legacy. And for a while, to start with, we talk about just how it felt to be in the Beatles after the Beatles, to carry that around. George was 24 when they finished Sgt. Pepper. It's like,
he's a baby.
A kid.
Yeah.
They're all still, you know, in their 20s when it's finished, really. You know, they sort of go into their 30s wondering who they are as individuals. Mm. And the world doesn't see them as individuals. The world sees them still as a Beatle. And that continues all the way through to the 90s. Obviously, it's also sad to touch on the fact that John never got the opportunity.
Mm.
And we also get to touch on the fact that as they make the anthology, there needed to be a lot of water under the bridge because they'd had their arguments, they'd said things, not that they take back, but things that they now understand they're all on a journey together, and this is a point in a journey where they can start to celebrate.
Mm.
So it's quite emotional, and that was the key, was to, as it is untethered and coming off the back of what is the definitive telling of their own story, it's kind of there to also talk about how it's at one point Ringo says that this is our anthology, it's not my anthology, and there's a big difference there.
Mm.
But there's an acknowledgement, a sort of joyful acceptance of selective memory, not manipulated memory, but this idea that it was such a mad thing. Mm. That the shared experience isn't, there's no such thing in a way. It's kind of everyone's looking at these happenings from their own corner of the room.
Mm.
And balancing that was difficult. And drawing a narrative line through those kinds of things is tricky. So some of that stuff doesn't get into episodes 1 to 8 because 1 to 8 has to make some choices, some decisions to take you
chronologically through
something.
Get through those years, yeah.
And I was able to scoop up some of the stuff that just doesn't fit because it's kind of working on different terms. And also, they did some interviews about the process of the anthology itself that we would recognize now as being part of something like a kind of coda episode or something like that. But at the time, although it was very interesting, except for things like an EPK or something like that, there was no...
There's no outlet for it,
the infancy of the internet and stuff like that. So you couldn't find these things. So we've got amazingly loads of unseen stuff just because the context was not there to be sort of widely distributed.
Yeah, and this is all the stuff presumably of like Paul and George and Ringo at George's estate in the country, and they're sort of reminiscing about, and they've got the ukuleles out and they're kind of reminiscing about the old days. Is that the kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's in there. So, we catch up with Paul's in New York where he's in kind of promo mode because they were records as well. I was saying earlier, it's a sort of tricky thing from a distribution perspective because it is, it's a 9-hour TV series, it's a set of albums, it's a book, and all these things need to be talked about in a certain way, some traditionally, some not so much. But while Paul was talking about the release of the albums, for example, in 95, that would have been, he talked about the making of the anthology, but it wasn't necessary for that purpose in that week to a deadline.
Mm.
And it, so it sits on a shelf. And I was very lucky to be sort of leading a team of people to grab this stuff. And it provides a whole new context to their story.
Yeah. And did you shoot new interviews of Paul and Ringo and the, you know, and Sean and the others for this episode, or was it all archive?
No, that was really important that, because it was made in the 90s. It wasn't like the Now and Then film that I made that came out in November 2023.
Mm.
That was for November 2023. So there was new interviews with Paul and Sean and Ringo and Peter Jackson. But with the anthology, you had to put yourself in this sort of weird head space, like going to work and shut the door in the edit and go, right, okay, well, it's 1995. Put it together because George is still around talking.
Mm.
So you can't start layering in surviving Beatles without creating this. It's one thing to make something where you're talking to people where your present day is 95 and you're going to jump back into various parts of the 60s or whatever. To then on top of that layer in, well, let's speak to Paul in 2024 or 25. It gets very weird, and it's a time capsule of where they were in 95. And it was really important, as nice as it would have been to have that kind of access and to ask questions that no doubt would have been interesting, as a whole, it would have done a disservice to what the anthology represents.
Yeah. You basically talk about crafting a time capsule of 95 with the footage that they gave you. And it's interesting reading about sort of different sort of statements you've given about like your process and your sort of your, how you approach the craft of making a music documentary. You talk a lot about how it's almost like you're building a time machine.
Yeah.
And like with all that footage of like, so whether it's the, the documentary made on Montreux or Ronnie Scott's or the Rolling Stones, you know, you've got access to all this stuff and you can use it in the right way to sort of create this little sort of simulacrum almost on screen of 65 or 66 at Ronnie Scott's or the Stones at that time or Bill Wyman. And it's interesting because watching back a lot of your work, you have a kind of, I mean, I'm intrigued because you have this sort of motif of using, and it's in the Beatles Now and Then short and in like your episode on the Rolling Stones, Keith Richards, you like to use sort of close-ups of like tape reels and tape decks and television sets and radios. And it's almost like you are creating like a space in the sort of confines of the documentary. And from there, it's almost like in the edit as a storyteller, you can kind of jump to any sort of point you want to go. You can pipe in Ronnie Scott's in 1967 from where you were before, which might have been earlier, or with the Beatles Now and Then, you can then pipe in the new single. And that's interesting to me because I think some documentaries, especially like, I guess, sort of more televisual ones that are made for television, are kind of just like, let's get some talking heads in, let's, you know, get some B-roll, just stick it together and throw it out there.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like you're more interested in creating a kind of a language with your films, which kind of, and I noticed it even on the Rolling Stones series, you know, there was a difference between the way that you were telling your story with Keith Richards in the second episode and the way that, you know, the director in episode one was telling the Mick Jagger story. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, how you approach the sort of language of what you do, I guess, in a sort of filmmaking sense.
You just did a great job of summing it up for me, but I would attempt to add something to it, which is, I think that is my experience of these projects, is being most of the time in the research phase by myself with a load of tapes. There's a lovely tactile sort of feeling of putting tapes into machines or putting reels up, and these things have a physical weight, you know, they occupy space on a shelf, and I'm always, I think, trying to relay something of my experience in these shows, especially when it came to, say, the Montreux series about Claude Nobbs. I'm stuck in Switzerland up a mountain during lockdown with 2,000 tapes. That isolation kind of leaks in to the film, because it has to, because I can't leave and I have a camera and I'm going to start filming all this stuff. And so that's maybe where it starts, but I don't like to be too derogatory of the, what you sort of might term the more sort of TV format docs, but it is largely down to budget, frankly, that it's easier to interview your subjects and film them. You will own that footage. You'll own those interviews. You cut it together. Whatever money you have left for B-roll, you can add your B-roll. The films I've made are a bit more expensive than that. Hopefully it does. You can see it on screen though, because that's where that extra money goes. And it's really kind of going back in time and telling a story in the present tense. And by the time you've got all these people together, from an access perspective, it's easier, say, to do something like this, where it's just, sometimes it's just me in a backpack of, because that's, I can get an audio interview that way. And some of these people that are very, very famous don't want seven people in their living room filming whatever's going on. They don't look the same as they used to. If you're getting archive of them looking their very best, say, in the mid-70s, and you come 30 years later and you film them in a chair, I'd forgive anybody for thinking, oh, I actually prefer if you show me looking $1 million.
Yeah, young and beautiful.
And I just talk, you know. So when I was lucky enough to interview Quincy Jones for the Ronnie Scott's film, exactly the same thing. It's kind of, you just sort of can sense it, that what you're going, access-wise, going to be able to get.
Mm.
And so it was built really around the idea of, if we're going to go back in time and tell the story, what's it going to add to see them 30 years down the line, unless it's Keith Richards and it's all about that whole journey and looking back. Makes perfect sense, so we do it. But I just don't take it as a given that a documentary means we're going to interview 12 people and hopefully do some reconstruction or some graphics or, but it, I suppose it's because documentary in its bones is a journalistic endeavour.
Mm.
And we're very lucky in the UK really to have somewhere like the BBC that will champion journalists to go and tell their stories on, you know, on film, you know, make great TV shows. If you spend any time out of the UK, especially now, mm-hmm. with what's going on politically, we're very lucky to have some great sort of televisual documentary. But I think maybe because I didn't come from that background, I just never had those preconceptions of component parts of what a documentary was. So I pieced it together instinctually,
mm.
starting with the Rolling Stone and a load of tapes and stuff. I think we're going to base the whole thing around this because this is amazing. We're not going to get the contributors or the bits and pieces. It has its drawbacks because from a distribution perspective, contributors are like your cast. The bigger or better your cast, in theory, the more viewable it is and the more they can get it around the world. But it's been such unusual times recently. If you sort of disregard the rules mm. as such, then I've been very lucky to have made my projects the way I want to make them, for better or worse.
Mm. So Keith Richards, you had, you know, tapes, and it was him in his Tudor house, and it was just like you guys, and it's like, right, let's just do this. It was as simple as that.
With Bill Wyman.
Oh, Bill Wyman, sorry, not
yeah.
with Keith.
Well, sort of simple, but it took about 4 or 5 years. Bill got sick in the middle of it, and we started off. I mean, I lived with him for periods of time, which was an amazing thing. Just talking about music and talking about what he wanted to do and how we wanted to do it. And that was a very organic, that was an amazing opportunity to find my feet and decide what kind of voice I wanted. Because when it's your first film, no one gives a shit. So people are just hoping it's not going to be a complete disaster.
Mm.
So that freedom is an amazing opportunity to make some choices. And then advice to people in that position is always not to take them too lightly, because if it goes well, someone will come back around and assume that there's a lot of you in your first show and ask you to do it again, one way or another. That did happen to me, because very quickly I got asked to make the film on Ronnie Scott's, because I sort of mentioned I'd be interested in that, and the producer, Eric Willard-White, was looking to do it. And it stands to reason, you know, they see your first film and think, great, well, let's do something on that same road with the next one. If your first film is not a good representation of you, you may well get asked to double down on that, and before you know it, you know, you're in a weird place if you're lucky.
You're stuck making something in a way that you weren't, that wasn't representative of you.
Yeah. So it's tricky, because there's lots of forces shaping any production,
mm.
but it's just so important to stand your ground with your first film as much as you can without doing too much damage to your relationships with people. But that's, you know, that's the one that no one's looking at you until it's out and later on, and it's your first big artistic swing. Mm. It's important.
Yeah, I mean, there's that quote about how it's applicable with films, I think, but also with like records, talking about music, that, you know, that the first record is always in some ways the strangest, because the artist doesn't, or the first film, the artist doesn't, is who they are, but they don't know who they are yet.
Yeah.
So it's in the DNA, but it's, the voice isn't quite there yet, but it's sort of being articulated.
Mm.
Was that kind of what it was like when you were doing your first films?
Yeah, I suppose so. But then also the first album or whatever is something that you've been working on your whole life up until that point.
Yeah.
So you've had all the time in the world to get two there. So you've got the first four or five tracks in the bag just to get to that point. And then the weird thing, the second one comes along and you've thrown everything at the first one. And you think, well, I don't know what the second one's going to be about. But for me, it was perfect to be given the opportunity to tell the Ronnie Scott story because that was such an important place for me. I never in a million years thought I'd go anywhere near the Rolling Stones. Just, you know, thinking, making music videos and the like. I would have loved to, but when I first got my first agent throwing that out there, it's been like, okay, well, what other pie in the sky stuff do you want? Like, what do you really want to do?
What's the dream list?
Yeah. So it was kind of, the second one was really jumping back to the first one because I had this dream opportunity first time around. And it went from there. So there's a semblance of control, but really you're like a pinball in a machine, just trying to kind of hold on to it.
Yeah, Brian De Palma said, rule number one with filmmakers and directors is like, when it comes to careers, is we don't plan them out. That is, one thing happens, we're working on one thing, and then something else happens, then we sort of pinball over to that, and then you're just trying to keep these sort of balls in the air and sort of do the best you can, I guess.
Completely. Well, they take so long to make. You also can't be led by what the industry's up to, because it will have changed by the time you, certainly by the time your production is out there. So really all you can do is stick to your guns about like, what is it, what story do you want to tell? Be open-minded at the idea of that it may not be the right time. So there's stories that I'd love to do. I think, well, maybe 5 years time, 10 years time even, when it, especially if it comes to music or arts and culture and fashions come and go and things like that. So cannot overstate that how important momentum is when a project really gets going, just pushing it over the edge, because there's always 100 reasons why it would probably be a good idea to pause and take stock. You just have to try and lead from the front and get it over the line.
Yeah, which seems like going right back to the beginning, like, you know, over the last 6 years, it's like one project after another and another, and you've been doing such great work. I mean, now that you've done, like you say, the pie in the sky dream list, you know, you've worked with some of the biggest bands, you've made docs on them, you know, Rolling Stones and the Beatles. I mean, do you feel like now the doors are being sort of kicked open completely? Like offers are coming in, like, you know, you can kind of direct a doc on any sort of act you like? Is that the experience?
If offers are coming in, they're sending them to the wrong email. But yes, I mean, I'm very fortunate things come and go. Some people think that because you're working for the Beatles that you wouldn't want to do other things, and you find out 6 months later that they would have loved to have sat down and asked my thoughts on certain stories, which is interesting, because actually the best thing to do after, you know, 2 years or so of Beatles work is to go right to the other end of the spectrum and work with a band or an act or whoever it is that are just starting out. So that's what I'd really love to do now, is kind of go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, possibly where there's, you know, absolutely no archive and it's all an observational documentary about bands or musician or whatever, you know, trying to make their way in the world, which is tough. One of the things that I like to try and highlight where I can with working on the anthology is the fact that it's interesting that the biggest touring acts at the moment are still Paul McCartney, The Stones, U2. It's a handful of new, and by new I mean last 10 years, the kind of acts that are making it work. And the music industry has always been the first in the arts to sort of show us where arts and culture in general is going. And it's so impossible for musicians to make a living from music now that we have to really start to rethink what's important and how we kind of cultivate opportunities, not just for musicians, but musicians, for filmmakers. Any creative sort of endeavor is getting squeezed so terribly. Mm. And it's important that we kind of wake up to the fact that, you know, like venues are, the economics of putting on music and live shows don't work. And there's not going to be some big weekend where they all crumble and we recognize that we need to do something. It's just going to slowly go. And it's going to, like, small towns first, and then it's going to encroach on the big cities.
Yeah, incrementally, yeah.
And it's so difficult to get them back once they've gone. It was an interesting thing when we released the Ronnie Scott's documentary. That was just after the pandemic. So we weren't expecting a story about a British jazz club to be a sort of of international resonance, you know, that kind of thing where everyone after the pandemic felt like, whether it was a music venue or a small theatre or a bookshop or just a cafe that they like to go to, if it didn't disappear, it got very close and everyone sort of felt that kind of tremor of what would happen if their favourite spot disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
If we are in a position to support these kinds of things, we need to. Because it's great to be working with the Beatles on these big, you know, on something as great as the anthology. It's also sort of bananas that the void is so ginormous behind. I mean, it's the Beatles. It's a different, they're sort of on the shelf under Beatles and nothing else. But then there's everything else. Great that Oasis had a moment. That was great. But what's coming next?
Mm. I mean, in terms of what you just said there about how, right, you've just done the Beatles and the Stones and these huge acts that are on that kind of, yeah, in their own strata, really. And then now, if you had the choice, you would go into the other end of the spectrum and do something much smaller scale, much more, you know, someone who's up and coming but who's really good. Yeah. I mean, are there any acts coming up that you would, that if you had, you know, the option, like some of your favourite acts that are coming up, like who would you sort of want to profile and sort of get on film?
It changes all the time. And if I say it out loud, that will invariably never happen. I am going to Turkey in 2 weeks to work with a streamer. I thought there'd be, given that it's a smaller act, I said a couple of days ago I was coming here today, I'm going to start talking about the Beatles and can I talk about what's happening next, and they said no. So ludicrous.
Yeah.
But you know, they've missed out. But I'm off to Turkey to do something with a smaller act all about immigration and the voice of immigration through music, which is exactly the kind of thing that I was hoping I'd be able to do after doing something as specific as the legacy of a band like the Beatles, is to go and do something that I also don't really know much about. Yeah. And put myself in that position of the audience and work with some really fantastic filmmakers out there in Turkey that have lived with some of these experiences that we're trying to put on film and things like that. And that's also the great thing about making documentaries, is you're sort of, you're professionally nosy. That's sort of what I kind of think of it as. I get to go out and make it my business to try and learn everything that I can about Turkish hip hop. I'm in.
Mm.
If I'd written 1,000 things down, or if you'd said, what would you like to do next? That wasn't even on my radar, but I can't wait to go and do it.
Well, I got to confess, Turkish hip hop's not particularly on my radar either. I mean, what is it about it specifically that is so sort of grabbing your attention and piquing your interest?
Well, there was a moment when a lot of Turks went to Germany Germany needed workers, and they answered the call, and then they had a particularly poor time, and I don't know, they experienced all sorts of, the jobs weren't there that were supposed to be there, but they may have been wanted on a sort of government level, but not on a sort of street level. And it's sort of the story, it's just these kids that at the time in the mid-90s, American hip-hop was huge, and they start rapping in their own language, which had never been done before.
Mm.
And it's kind of what happens when this new youth culture meets Turkish culture, which is one of the, you know, oldest cultures in the world. I'm in.
Yeah, it's the old and the new kind of colliding by the sounds of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that reminds me what you just said there, a bit of like, yeah, because you say sort of youth culture and hip hop sort of is sort of spreading further and further and disseminating. I mean, it reminds me a bit of, obviously, I think an obvious example these days would be Kneecap, I guess, you know, the Irish hip hop.
Yep.
and they're rapping in their own language, and it is about the original language, and it's about that culture and sort of, and getting it out there. And I guess it's a similar sort of vibe in Turkey.
Yeah. We sort of take it back to the 90s and talk about the first instances of Turkish hip hop and take it through to what it means to people to be seen, that sort of brotherhood, that kind of ability to to have yourself reflected in the music, and then when you're making a documentary like this, you know, have yourself reflected ultimately on a TV screen as well. So that 2 weeks' time, I'm off to start that.
Exciting. Linking it back to the Beatles quickly. I mean, I feel like everyone gets that. Everyone has their favourite Beatle. Everyone, so I guess, and I guess if you've worked with the Beatles, this is, I guess, a slightly more sort of pressing question than others. But do you have a favourite Beatle?
Chops and changes, of course it does. But working with Paul and going to his studio and being so blown away with his openness for creatives to come into his space and make work with him is an unbelievable experience to have. And then watching him now, it's sort of possibly, you know, it's obviously not fair on the others to say how prolific he is now. In that, but the fact that the man is still going and not, he's not sitting on a stool somewhere doing an acoustic gig because he's slowing down. He's playing to like 250,000 people in South America 4 times a week. It's closer to 90 soon than... it's crazy. So for those reasons and a whole load more pull at the moment.
Yeah. Do you think that's also partly because you play bass? So is it, you know...
I wouldn't like in any way to say that I play bass in the way that Paul plays. I wouldn't. No. Let's make that clear. I don't think of myself as a co-bass player in the lines of Paul McCartney. But no, he's just a absolute creative force. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
That's what was so amazing about watching Get Back when that came out, you know, a few years ago, was the fact that I feel like Paul sometimes maybe in some with some fans, and maybe even by occasionally John and George at the time, kind of got tarred with the brush of like, you know, we're kind of fragmenting here. We all kind of want to do our own thing. And Paul has to kind of be the mum of the group for like a good stretch of time after, you know, Epstein dies, Brian Epstein. That's a lot of responsibility. And watching Get Back, it was just a sense of like, this guy just won't stop. Yeah. And the fact that he's pumping out these tracks, like almost off camera at times, there's that great bit in Get Back where I think John is talking to maybe George Martin about, you know, about how we're going to do the set for the show, and then in the background off camera you can literally hear Macca like composing Let It Be on the piano. And it's like this guy in like however many weeks they had to get ready for that rooftop gig is cranking out these songs.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the fact that and he just wouldn't stop. And it's like Ringo says, you know, he's the workaholic, he's the pro, I guess, in some ways, of the kind of the four.
Yeah,
because he's on it.
Yeah,
all the time.
My other favorite bit in that series is one of them might be George or Ringo, one of them's like 15 minutes late and he uses their 15 minutes to write Get Back.
Yeah.
And the fact that in that series you just get to watch it kind of emerge out of this sort of early, this sort of meditative thing where he's just humming and playing. And the amazing thing is also when he does it, he knows he's got something in that sort of stream of consciousness of music. I imagine in his head an awful lot, he's able to siphon off something and just happens to be that. And he doesn't do it once or five times or dozens of times in that period. It's just an unbelievable creative. So, one of the greats of all time.
Totally.
And it's easy. Yeah. It's hard to talk about his talent, really, because everyone said everything there is to say, but it's extraordinary.
Yeah, and when you were making sort of the anthology and Now and Then, because I want to say Jonathan from Apple did the interviews with Paul for that, but then you were in the room as well.
Yeah.
So you met Paul and you had got to sort
that
of hang out.
That played out over a couple, two or three instances. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, and so you're in the room with your favourite Beatle. I mean, what's that like?
Professionally, well, it's quite good. I can sort of divorce myself from how famous someone is, sit down and do an interview or hang out with them and do the sort of small talk and get the stuff done we need to do. And then it's usually like the following morning or that weekend that I just absolutely lose my shit over what's just happened. But it never happens in the moment. It has like a delayed fuse on it, because otherwise you just sort of, I'm sure it has happened to him, that people just sort of cease to function as a normal human in his presence. But I kind of go into a sort of completely other world of he's just a guy. You sort of hang on to this idea and you come very, very prepared so you can lock into your prep. And I think that's important. If you don't lock into the prep, then you're sort of actually just engaging with the person that he is, then I think my brain would go to porridge. But you just stick to the plan and get it done.
Yeah. And surely he's, you know, like you say, he's been doing this for 60, you know, odd years at this point. You know, he's seen it all. He's done it all. So I guess he's quite laid back.
He's seen it all, but he wants things to be great because he's Paul McCartney. So he's on top of it and he loves it. Still playing. There's more stuff coming out next year and his book. And sometimes I think, God, if anyone's used his time on the planet wisely, and it just, he's such a grounded individual as well. And it's a fantastic life that he's led.
Yeah. And the fact that I think all of the Beatles, you know, until the end kind of, and obviously Paul and Ringo still with us, like they haven't lost their sense of humor, which is obviously such a key part of their whole makeup.
Yeah.
Like Paul's still funny. Like Paul's still, you know, and Ringo is still hilarious. They're still cracking jokes. I mean, Eric Idle was talking about, he was going to perform a song on sort of American late night TV quite recently. You know, I remember he was on the radio quite recently and he was going to do a sort of early McCartney track. So pre-Beatles, but early McCartney. Mm. And he phoned up Paul and he said, you know, do you mind if I use this song? And Paul was like, tell me when it is, tell me what channel so I can not watch it. And so the fact that, you know, the guy's still, you know, he has his wit, you know, it's still, which is fantastic.
That's how you survive through it, I think.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I assume you've seen Paul play live, like you've been to one of his gigs and...
Do you know what? I've not.
You never?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, because I saw him, I was lucky enough to see him last Christmas at the O2. And it's like you were saying about like the big acts, like, you know, Paul, Taylor Swift, you know, the Rolling Stones, like they're playing for such long gigs.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a marathon, isn't it? It's like 2 hours at least of just, and it's song after song. And after
I think it's
song.
Almost three when he goes to South America because he doesn't have this sort of curfew type thing. I mean,
oh, really?
Yeah, and he's got the hits and he will play them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Every single song is basically, everyone knows the words to virtually every single song, which is just extraordinary, yeah.
Yeah.
And Ringo even comes out at the end, you know.
Yeah, sometimes. I was supposed to be at that gig and I was bummed out when I read about that later on.
I was, because he did two nights and Ringo comes out on the last night and me and my mate were there the night before. So not only did we miss Ringo by one night, we also missed him pulling out the famous lost bass that he had. So it was just, you know, we had to just take our lumps with a grin, you know, just be like, okay, we saw Paul, that's enough, you know, but secretly fuming. One last question about the anthology, because as you were saying, like the anthology sort of format, you've got the Beatles and their team and they're telling the story, their own story themselves, you know, and it's an incredibly sort of simple but robust format of like you've got Ringo talking to camera, you've got Paul and George and then the roadies and all the guys. And as I say, simple but robust because it's very direct and you just get a sense of like these are you know, Paul, George and Ringo and John when he gets piped in, you know, you have audio of him, pre-recordings of him talking and it's just very, it's quite intimate. And I guess for you, when you were doing your episode of the new anthology, because as we say, you like to be quite inventive with the sort of documentary format. Did you feel like you had to adhere to that sort of original format of just simple sort of talking heads, you know, B-roll, kind of cut quite simply, or did you have the opportunity to get more inventive with it?
Yes, we did in short term. I think it was more because it was archival from the 90s and because George and John aren't with us, the archive and the talking heads, or certainly it felt like it was an opportunity to give George a voice, you know, that he wouldn't have in any other way. Obviously there's no, if he didn't say it on tape or film, we're never going to hear him say it again. So it was important to lean into that a bit more. But I think it goes back to what I was saying before, that I'm more than happy to use talking heads if the North Star is, if we're talking about emotions and contextualizing how they feel about something, stands to reason you want to see, he's talking about how he feels now in that moment, not tell me about how you felt all that time ago. So when he's talking about being a kid, we see him being a kid. But if he's talking about when I saw them all for the first time last week, then we're in that moment. So the story sort of catches up with itself. So it's them doing a sit-down interview in the 90s to talk about the 90s. So there's more interviews, there's more filmed interview than I would have normally gone for, certainly more than my previous work. But it was because it was all justified about in the, it all fits to that sort of mode of, it's a time capsule, it's hopefully a time machine that takes you back to that capsule. And they did some great seated interviews and talked about things that they haven't talked about before or since.
It's interesting because I know a lot of the year's original interviews were done by Jules Holland, I want to say.
Yeah, Jules is in there.
Yeah.
It's funny, actually, the when you see the rushes, it was shot on film but framed for 4:3. So when we went and scanned some of that stuff again, we get the full frame. And there's certain interviews where, say, Paul's on his boat, tugboat.
Which is insane, by the way. That's like one of the greatest sort of interview setups ever. It's just you got Paul McCartney.
I think I should be on my boat at this moment. But because the boat is very small and the camera can only be where it is and the lens is the way it is to get the whole thing in a 4:3 frame, when you go wider, you can see Jules Holland crouched down.
Yeah, like a microphone.
Asking the questions, thinking he's safe and out of frame. All these years later, you come back.
Yeah.
There he is.
Yeah. Whenever you talk about, like, you know, these films, like, you know, Now and Then and the anthology, and, you know, you clearly seem to relate to me. It seems relate to them on quite you have to relate to them on a personal level.
Yeah, you do.
The film you're making, because, as I say, it can be quite a journalistic exercise sometimes in terms of just like putting information across, like this happened with George and then this happened with Paul. But then it seems to me you're coming at it from like, how do I relate to this material? And what is the story? What's the heart of this actually about? Like Now and Then, you know, it's about the Beatles making their last song, but also it's about, I mean, you were saying it's kind of about brotherhood across time. Like that's what it's really about.
Yes.
And how important do you think is that to like actually when you're making a film as a documentary?
Massive. Good music documentaries aren't about music. And good music isn't straightforward music. It's coming from somewhere else. So you sort of have to, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a place for it where you see someone sitting at a desk and talking, or seeing an amazing performance is a fantastic thing. But that's take away the performative element of it. And music is someone's expression of themselves. So the starting point for me is, anyone, whether a musician or a filmmaker, you start out and at one point you're both just kids with a dream to do something. And I think that's the bit that's where it starts, where you can relate to, and the arc of the story of a kid with a dream. It's why those sort of biopics of like even good ones, you know, like Ray or Bohemian Rhapsody or something like that, they're all variations on kids with dreams. Am I going to make it big, whatever that means? But really, from a documentary format, it's mostly, will I express myself the way I hoped I could do that? Or something, it's a different, it's complicated for each individual. But that is no different from making a film. I'm thinking, like, well, will I make something bigger than the sum of its parts, I suppose. And so it doesn't matter if it's Paul McCartney or a Wonder Kid, they're still trying to do the same thing. And if you can tap into that energy and find the complications and make it specific and interesting, that's the other thing. It's got to be culturally specific, because otherwise it gets a bit generic. And so if you hang on to those key linchpins, then that's how it starts. And I think that's how you can draw a line between someone that is similar to the audience. That's where you got to tether their story to the audience in a meaningful way so they can have their emotional response to it. The moment you put them on a pedestal, it's over. Or the moment you are distancing yourself, it's just going to double the distance from the audience as well. And then they feel like this sort of other entity, you know, like a concert film or something. If you watch Michael Jackson and a concert film, you just unbelievable. But he just doesn't feel like an actual person that's then going to walk off and go and have some dinner and get some kip, because he's got to do it all again. It's just a different thing. So it's punching holes in that sort of veneer towards something that that is a universal truth.
Mm, yeah, and it's getting under the skin of that, isn't it? And I get, and that was always, I guess, linking this back to the Beatles, that was always their core appeal, wasn't it? Is that they were, for however sort of monolithic and universal they were just like four lads from Liverpool.
Absolutely.
And, like, and each with their own voice and each with their own sort of energy, and, you know, that, and people could relate to that.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah. And it still is informing everything that they're doing up till now.
Completely.
Yeah. Great. Well, I think that's all we've got time for half the picture this
time.
Thanks
for having me.
My pleasure. Cheers, all.
Thank you.
Good chat. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to my chat with Ollie Murray. Remember to like and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And stay tuned for more exciting interviews and guests coming soon on Half the Picture.